A Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 400,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Tom on Leadership. Broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. Here's your host, Tom Cox.
And I start the episode by saying there are two things. One, David Marquet is back. He's got a second book, a follow-up to Turn Your Ship Around. And in my intro, I'm lying to you because it's not live from Portland, Oregon today. Today I'm in Houston, Texas, coming to you live from my hotel room, where it's slightly less early in the morning for this live broadcast. Delighted to have back one of my favorite interview subjects and the author of one of only four or five books in the core Becoming a Best Boss reading list, along with Mark Goulson's Just Listen and Peter Drucker's On Managing Oneself. David Marquet has written a follow-up to Turn the Ship Around. This is Turn Your Ship Around. It's a workbook companion, workbook for implementing intent-based leadership. And as I'm getting ready to write my book on the best boss experience and what it is to be the best boss anyone's ever had, and I'm thinking, of course, my next thing is going to have to be a workbook, and this is such a good workbook. Dude, how did you come up with the format, the content? How did you make it so good?
Thanks, Tom. Well, it's great to be back on your show.
Thank you.
Well, it kind of started back with a good editor when I wrote my book, who said, hey, why don't you include some questions at the end of the chapters and get people thinking? And I was initially a little resistant to that idea, but ultimately I listened to my editor. And so, as you know, in the original book, Turn the Ship Around, I have a small set of questions. And a lot of people came back to me and said, hey, those questions were great. I really, I used them with my team to start doing things and to kind of spread the word. And then as I started getting invited to do some talks, people would say, well, what do we do? How do we do it? What's the first step? What activities, can we replicate the activities you did with us, with our team? And so rather than, putting together some binder of workshop materials that I would charge $200 for, I would say, well, let's just put it all together in a workbook and we'll make it a paperback and we'll sell it for as low as possible on Amazon. We'll just let any leader who has any interest in trying to move this way, just give them everything that we know in terms of the activities that we do. So that's really, that's really what the workbook, that's where it came from. And we've seen pretty good success where people take in the workbooks and they can do the activities with their teams.
Yeah,
especially if they don't want to or need to or don't have the motivation or the schedule, to get me to come out, which I love to do.
Sure.
But
right,
you can't be everywhere.
Yeah, this is a great force multiplier because you may not be able to hire David Marquet, but by golly, you could hire this workbook. In fact, you could buy it outright, scribble it, and then buy another one. $15 is what says on the back of mine. So you say the lessons. Of course, not everyone's heard your first interview, which is a tragedy. It's a shame they do not have the book.
Shocking.
That's okay. It happens. And so we'll do a quick recap.
Yeah.
And the good news, of course, is that the chapters seem to follow conceptually the book pretty well. And I love that we start off with think about the long term, even beyond your own tenure with your organization. So there's this immediately a sense that you could and should view your leadership role as a position not of privilege, but of responsibility, of caretaking, of stewardship. The phrase servant leadership is often used, and I think poorly understood by far too many.
Yeah.
It's the sense that you're going to make the organization better. Everyone who reports to you is going to be better off, smarter, more capable, more self-reliant, more a better teammate, more technically competent, more aware of the strategy of the organization. And you're going to do it step by step. And this literally will lay out, it lays out the steps you go through as a leader to then lead your people step by step through bringing up their game, taking on more responsibility, but not too fast.
Right.
And it starts off with this, you know, long-term thinking in chapter 3, care but don't care.
Right.
I love that one. Recap that lesson briefly, if you would.
Well, so my fundamental story for the guys who happened to miss the first session is I was a nuclear submarine captain, and I was assigned to the worst ship in the fleet unexpectedly at the last minute. So I wasn't trained for that particular submarine. And to make the story short, let me just say, I gave an order which couldn't be performed, but my crew tried to do it anyway. And I realized the problem wasn't that I gave a bad order. The problem was that I was the one giving orders. The problem wasn't that I gave a bad order. It was that I was the one giving orders. And so as the captain, I made this decision. What I can do, like I could give my guys a lecture and say, oh, you guys need to be more proactive. You guys need to be, quote, empowered. You guys need to give me forceful backup. But what I could do, but that's kind of putting it on others. What I could do was to stop giving orders. And so I made this deal with my guys that I was going to stop giving orders. I would give them intent. Here's what we're trying to achieve here. And then they would give me their intention. They would say, they would not ask permission. They would not say request permission to do this. They would say, I intend to reposition the submarine. I intend to load a torpedo. I intend to submerge the ship. And in the short run, we went from, you know, worst to first in terms of morale and retention and performance on evaluations and our inspection scores. And everyone kind of gets excited about that story, and that's fun. But the real story, and the reason I wrote the book, is what happened 10 years later. Because when people are treated as leaders, no matter where they are in the organization, and when I say they're treated as leaders, it means, hey, I want to know what you're thinking. You get to make the decision. I'm going to give you as much decision-making power and authority as possible. Then they develop those thinking leadership skills. So what happened was, over the next 10 years, the submarine generated more submarine captains. We had 10 people selected to be submarine captains from the wardroom of officers. Right.
Which so is this insanely is the, high.
It's an insanely high. I did some statistics one day, and it's something like if it were to happen randomly, of all the submarines in the fleet, it would be like a 1 in 100 year occurrence. So it's an insanely high number. And this was the reason I wrote the book, because this was the power of the story that people didn't understand. And people will say, well, what's my legacy? People want to know that they matter. When they came onto the planet and they were here for some brief period of time and then they left, what's their legacy? What are we leaving behind? What does it all matter? And is it just, oh, I came and made a bunch of money and then I died? Or did I actually touch the lives of people around me? And this idea that I'm going to measure your achievement while you're in the position, but I'm going to measure your leadership as soon as you leave your position, I think is powerful and seems to be striking a chord with people, because they want to know, did I matter?
Yeah.
Did I matter? So care, but don't care,
of course,
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I can answer that, but go ahead, Tom.
Right. So what I loved in reading the Care But Don't Care chapter 3 message is you got to pick your fight, pick what you focus on. In your case, you chose to care completely about your people and essentially not care whether you get promoted, whether you get an award, whether you get criticized.
Right.
You know, looking back, it succeeded. But looking forward, you're like, I have the worst boat in the Navy, and I don't understand it very well because I spent 12 months preparing for a different boat. And so I don't even have the systems in my ship.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, we had no idea whether this was going to work. When I went to my guys and said, look, I'm trained for one ship. You guys are trained to follow orders. That's a deadly combination. What do you think we should do? And we said, well, you know, Captain, you know, the best solution here is for you just not to give orders. And I said, I'm willing to do that if you guys are willing to say, you know, something. No one knew what that was going to look like. What does it look like? Right. No one knew that it was going to be successful. It's like, oh, well, now there's a book. And so there's sort of this sense of preordained success. That couldn't be farther from the truth. And we made mistakes, which fortunately we didn't hurt anybody. But and the mistake the mistake that I made was I gave too much control too fast. And I think this is a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
Although what I usually see is people err on the other side. They're like, so as leaders, they say, oh, look, when you show me empowerment, when you show me initiative, when you show me maturity, when you show me this judgment for making a decision, I will then step back and allow you to make more decisions. It doesn't work like that. Because until you step back and give the person the chance to make some decisions, you have no idea. They don't have the opportunity to demonstrate those things.
Right.
So
right.
The leader always has to take the step first. The leader has to step back and say, okay, I call it suck air through teeth, right? It's the, what's going to happen here? Right?
Yes.
And the key is, how big of a step do you take? If you take a step, then you overtax the system and the person's going to make a mistake because they're not ready for it.
Yep.
But if you don't take a step at all, then it's stultifying. So you got to take a little step. You got to see where they are. You mm-hmm. you practice being successful, making decisions lower in the organization. Then you take another step, and then you take another step, and then you take another step. And every day, you're sucking air through your teeth.
Right. As you can imagine you're standing face-to-face with your direct report, and you want that person to step in your direction, you know, because you've got the power in the leadership, and you want to give them, bring them more into where you are. If you're standing nose to nose and they try to step forward, there's nowhere to go.
Exactly.
If you step back about a foot, if they trip, you can catch them. If you step back about 7 feet and they trip, they're falling on their face right in front
of you. Yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly the way I picture it in my head, yes.
So giving them some space and you're there to catch them. And so you're creating a sense of emotional safety that, you know, yes, if you screw up, you totally will screw up and you'll have to clean it up and we'll both look bad and you'll be a little bit embarrassed, but it's not going to be huge and we'll learn something good from it. And everyone's doing this, including you, and it's really not an option because I'm stepping back now.
Right. And people will say, well, what about the person who never steps forward? Okay, that might happen. You as a leader cannot, quote, force a person to take a step forward. There are people out there who've been conditioned for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years to just do what they're told, keep their head down, keep their mouth shut. Those people are going to take a long time to say, oh, no, now I'm giving you, and they may never change. And that's fine. You can't, quote, force them. But I'm telling you, there's so many people out there who are just craving to have the ability to have more control over their life, more control over the decisions they make at work. Because when they go home, they say, oh, I actually did something that mattered rather than, oh, I just, you know, went to work and took orders, did what I was told. I mean, how like not exciting is that?
Right. And if you've ever, let me take it even further and make it worse. Let's say you've got some responsibility and you're about to do it and you discover your boss came and did it for you.
Yeah. One of the things that we talk about, one of the activities in the workbook is a thing called the ladder of leadership. And the ladder of leadership is this construct where we say, okay, for every decision, remember, for every decision, there's always two decisions. Decision number one is the operational decision. Do we ship the parts or not? Do we include the feature in the software or not? Decision number two is who actually gets to make decision number one. Right? And how do we make the decision? Now, it's not a light switch. It's not like I make it or you make it, typically. But at the bottom of the ladder, we have the boss making the decision. Okay, you guys are going to update the software, and the release is going to be June 30th. Okay, well, we probably impossible. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm telling you it was June 30th. Okay, so that's at the bottom of the ladder.
Right.
And then as you move up, the workers have more voice, and they say, you know, here's what we think, here's what we, and at some point it shifts, and the workers say to the boss, hey, we intend to release the new feature on June 30th, the new software update on June 30th is going to include the following features. We've scoped it. We know this is feasible. We're going to do it, and we're committing to it. And so that's the idea of,
right.
I can't even remember where I was going with the story, but you know, basically
yeah,
that's the idea. As you move up the ladder, you get more and more voice to the workers, and then they feel like they matter.
Because, of course, they do. And
correct.
The lovely thing about the seven steps in the ladder, I love, by the way, the fact that that ladder was originally written by Dr. Stephen Covey, who had visited your ship. I just love that fact. And it's such a nice progression. It's completely natural. It's logical. It's easy to follow. It's almost baby steps, so that as the leader trying to grow others, my subordinates into leadership, I have a step-by-step process from here's what you're going to do to tell me your thoughts. Oh, I have to have thoughts?
Yeah.
You better practice
right.
for a while. Okay, now I'm
right.
having thoughts. Okay, now I want you to pick one of those thoughts and make it your recommendation. Oh,
right.
I have to pick one.
Perfect.
And if they're not
right.
able to do those two things, you're not going to the third one. And practice, practice, practice. And when they give their thoughts and you hear them, that's huge. When you hear their thoughts and you make it, they get used to that. And then you say, give me a recommendation, and maybe you do it, maybe you don't. And when either one, you should explain to them. See, now you're training them to think like you, because they're starting
right.
to see, oh, yeah, Tom likes that, or Tom feels this way. And then you can say, it's not that I like it. It's I'm looking at all these other concerns. And eventually, I've downloaded all my concerns to you, and now you think like I think. Your judgment is somewhat like my judgment. You at least will anticipate what Tom will object to, so you can make recommendations based
right.
on a shared understanding of reality. And if you want to argue for your position, you're going to give me all kinds of data and ideas and thoughts and perspectives that you got that I didn't have until you opened your mouth, and I've now trained you to talk to me. I've trained
well,
you to share your thoughts.
Right. And I would add just one little, again, nuance on what you just said, which is when – so leaders out there, when you're having these conversations and you start – and you go to your people and say, well, tell me what you think. What would you do here? They're going to say things that might seem odd to you.
Yep.
They're going to give you the, quote, wrong answer. And what I urge you to do is adopt a blank mindset. So in other words,
right.
don't say, oh, they're wrong, I'm right. Let me ask a bunch of questions and some sort of Socratic, you know, trickery and guide them artfully to the, quote, promised land. Instead, say, you know what? They're closer to the problem than I am. They're the ones who are operating the machine. This is the guy who's actually doing the coding, whatever it happens to be. This is the guy who's actually sat in the client's office, right? Not me. So listen to what they're saying very carefully with the idea that they might be right. Now, at the end of the day, they might not be right. And if you say, you know, I heard what you're saying, we're still going to do it this way. Two things happen. One is because they've been heard, it's okay. The problem with people, when you just go to people and say, like, I don't care what you think, we're going to do it this way, is they don't feel like they've been heard. If they feel like they've
yeah.
been heard and then we still decide not to do it our way, there's really not much sting in that. And so all the resistance that comes from, you know, the boss is a dumb idea, but the boss said to do it, right? So you get this grudging compliance.
Yeah. Right.
All that goes away. The large measure of it goes away because they felt like, Al, they gave me a fair shake. Listen to what I said. And he or she decided to go a different way. So that's the, you know, the benefit of that.
There's a wonderful photo I found that has one of those little signs out in front of a shop with the movable letters. It says, it'll say, you know, happy birthday to somebody, or our special today is, or whatever. Little sign. And sometimes they're funny. And this one reads, "My boss said to change the sign, so I did."
Yeah.
And that's what the sign reads.
That's
looking
awesome.
At this, I'm thinking, okay, I call that malicious compliance.
Malicious compliance.
Right, when you do exactly what you were told in a way that doesn't actually move things forward for the organization. And malicious compliance thrives. You don't always see it that obviously. Sometimes it's hidden for months or years. And the more you dehumanize people by taking away their choices and their inputs, and the more resentful they're going to get, they just will, trust me. The more they'll say, well, you want the sign changed, and you probably didn't tell me why. You probably didn't tell me how. And you probably didn't collect, you know, input from people on what should the sign say, who wants to have input on the sign, and do we want to be funny, what's our culture, how do we want to interact with the world. You know, I drive past that place, I think, wow, command and control hell in there.
Right.
You can give somebody an order they don't know how to follow.
Right. So I want to, I totally agree with that. With the story, I don't advocate that sort of passive aggressive response.
No,
to your
terrible.
Boss,
it's
but,
evil. It's awful.
But I want to pick up on something, Tom, that you said, which you said, hey, when you take a step, when you're only a foot from the person, there's a sense of emotional safety.
Yeah.
Can I riff off of that for a second?
Please.
So when we do workshops and keynotes, we do this interactive thing. Where I get to ask a group questions and they pull in their response. So one of the questions I ask is, hey, if you got you got a person at level one on the ladder, they're tell me what to do, and you say, well, what do you think? And they just seem stuck at tell me what to do, and they're like, well, I don't know. You're the boss. Like, you've always been the one who's done the thinking. No one asked me. Well, you know, I don't know what to think.
Yeah.
Right.
What are you trying to do to me?
Yeah. What Jedi mind trick are you trying to play on me? Like, what are you, and so the question is, what is keeping people stuck at tell me what to do?
Yeah.
I've done this on 100 conferences. I've done it on 4 continents in, I don't know, 25 different countries. The number one word that comes up every time is fear.
Fear.
It's always fear. Like, when you say, well, what do you think? It's like, well, that the thing that keeps people there is fear. So this sense of emotional safety is super important. And so I think because workers are going to say, oh, well, you're trying to trick me into telling you what I think so that you can then blame me when the thing doesn't come out right. And so you got to say, you know, so if you're one of these persons who's just really stuck at tell me what to do, you got to make it safe for them. You got to say, look, this is my decision. If it goes wrong, it's going to be on me. But you see things that I don't see. You know things that I don't know. You know, and we have some different strategies. So for example, one strategy is make it small. Don't say, well, should we ship the parts or not? Just say, hey, tell me about the machine. How's the machine been operating this week? What's the batch look like? How important is this client? You know, break it down into some smaller things and try and get them talking about things that are in their domain. And then as soon as they do that, that's a win, right? And don't press it. And then say, okay, that's really helpful. Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to do this. And every day you just practice it. It's like, people think leadership stuff is like, you know, they'll say, hey, I'm going to go to a leadership class, right? And that picture history class. I'm going to learn a bunch of stuff and stuff it up in my head. It's not like that at all. Leadership class is more like sports camp, right? I'm going to be practicing drills.
That's right.
And it's going to involve other people. And it's just going to be about practice.
Yeah, you're going to break down the skill into its component pieces. By the way, another very important book in the Best Boss canon is by Daniel Coyle. He's the author of The Talent Code, but he came up with a lovely little book called The Little Book of Talent, 52 Tips for Improving Your Skills. And it's how do you practice hard skills, how do you practice soft skills, what are the differences? And I'm using this book as a guidepost in my Best Boss training system to figure out what's the best way for me to train each of these things. Like, is it hard? Is it soft? which needs to come before what, and so on. Fascinating look, and I recommend the book highly. In fact, if you have a couple more books in your future, I'm looking very much forward to the collected stories of people employing the leader-leader model and the turn the ship around model. I know that there's many, many stories. We're talking offline and we don't have time to go into them. The collected stories is going to be a great book. And I'm hoping a short book of the condensed tips might also be in the future at some point. If you do, I recommend you. I'm hoping you'll model it on Daniel Coyle, C-O-Y-L-E, Coyle's Little Book of Talents. I want to back up to every time I read one of the chapter headings, I go, ooh, I like that. For instance, achieve excellence, don't just avoid errors. I get so annoyed with people who are all into problem solving. It's the whole Lean Six Sigma engineer mindset. We're going to solve problems. And everything's a problem to be solved. Well, okay, problem solving is actually a low energy negative mindset. Great mindset. There's four major mindsets. It's one of them. Problem solving is useful. It's helpful. It's wonderful. And it doesn't get you to excellence. And one of the best ways to avoid errors and, you know, is just don't do anything. And so an error avoidance culture becomes a non-innovative, stagnant, zero initiative culture, which you highlight very, very beautifully. And there's a whole chapter in here on how to notice if you're doing that to yourself and how do you fix it? Return the problem unsolved is another chapter. And again, I get a little thrill. I'm like, yeah, eliminate top-down monitoring systems. So that doesn't give somebody goosebumps to think I'm gonna lose. What about my emotional safety? As a leader, if I don't have top-down monitoring, I'm doomed. No, you're going to replace it with better things. talk briefly, if you would, please. Think out loud for us. Another chapter title, Think Out Loud. Think out loud for us, David, how and why I would get rid of my top-down monitoring, my safety blanket.
Right. So when you have, we used to have this big industry of top-down monitoring. I would maintain lists of things that my subordinates ought to do. They maintain lists of the department heads maintain lists that the division officer should do. Division officer maintain lists that the chief should on and on and on. Well, all that is about compliance, conformity, and getting people to do what they're told. Mm-hmm. I think basically what's happening is in the last 500 years, during the Industrial Revolution, the focus was on doing. Organizations that, quote, did the best, manufactured the best, reduced errors, right? They took a steam engine, they improved it. It's about doing. And so what happens is in a doing world, it's about compliance and these to-do lists become very, right? They're called to-do lists, right? We come to work and do our job. So what happens is I think we've shifted. And the most important thing now is not doing, but thinking. So when you go to thinking, basically everything that you are doing for doing actually becomes counterproductive. And this was the big sort of aha moment that I had. So all these things like telling people what to do, which was good for doing, is counterproductive in thinking. Pushing information to authority so the authority can make a decision was good for doing, but it's counterproductive for thinking. So basically everything gets flipped on its head. And the key is like, how do we create an environment where and a culture where people they have the authority to make decisions, but we still get this unity of effort. We still get everyone moving in the same direction. I think this is why, just kind of to wrap up here, leadership is so hard because you need, as the leader, you move in the emotionally difficult direction. In other words, you create more uncertainty for you when you tell people you get to make the decision. You deliberately reduce your status. When you say, that's on you. Yeah, you can tell me what to do. You can tell me what you think we should do here. I'm not going to command you, right? So you're going to be reducing your status. You're increasing uncertainty. You're going to be reducing the amount of control over your life. And your brain is going to say, no, that's wrong. Because your brain is wired to increase certainty, to increase status, and to increase control. But what you do is when you do that, you increase it for everybody around you, right? That's why leadership is hard. And everyone around you then feels better. And then they become, like you said, you become the best boss. But you become the best boss because you not wasn't anything physically hard, but you just emotionally went to the dark place. You went to a place that felt uncomfortable for you. If you are feeling uncomfortable as a leader, you're not leading.
I love it. What a great rule of thumb. If you're not feeling uncomfortable, you're not a leader. I wrote down here as you were talking, certainty, status, and control. So, by the way, when we go over 30 minutes, the live stream people don't hear anymore, but the recording is still going, and we've got another 3 or 4 minutes to wrap up.
Super.
The guy named Chris Argyris wrote a number of wonderful books that became famous through Peter Senge's novel, The Fifth Discipline, and some others. Argyris has this essay. It's called Teaching Smart People to Think, and he was studying people like me, management consultants, and he found out that we were terrible at this, that we hated uncertainty, and he actually laid out a series of things that people try to do that's harmful to their own learning. One is they try to force an increase in certainty, they try to force an increase in unilateral control, so they don't think out loud, they hide their thinking process from others.
Right,
and it's a very sort of defensive crouch, and so defensive that you actually new data cannot permeate. And I was so moved by that passage in Teaching Smart People to Think by Argyris that I actually copied it out longhand into my journal because I wanted to savor the words. It was it was really something, and you just echoed it for me again. And this is how you're going to learn more, and other people are going to learn more.
Yeah, so let me just stomp my foot on that a little bit.
Yeah.
In the old world, right, the leader who says, I don't know, is a bad leader, right? When people come up to the leader and say, well, what should we do here?
Right.
I don't know. What does this button do? I don't know, right? That's, quote, bad leadership. I give seminars and I ask people, if you said the word, I don't know, would your people think you were a good leader or a bad leader? And a lot, I get a lot of people think I'm a bad leader. This is the problem. But if you want people to think, saying, I don't know. And oh, by the way, saying, I don't know, that opens the door to your own learning. As long as you think you know, what sense is it? I know the causes of the Civil War. Am I going to learn anything about the causes of the Civil War? No. Only when I say, you know what? I might not understand the causes of the Civil War. Can I learn more about the causes of the Civil War? And so if you want to know exactly what you know now, 50 years from now, not a lick more, then yes, know everything. And never say, I don't know. Saying, I don't
we
know.
Are it's completely.
Just, yeah, you're with me. Hey, where'd you go?
A Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 400,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how. A Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 400,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.